For our third must-listen interview and replay from this year, we present to you a thought-provoking and non-politically correct discussion with Alex Epstein on his book Fossil Future, Why Global Human Flourishing Requires More Oil, Coal, and Natural Gas, Not Less. It came out in May of 2022 and has continued to dominate as the number one best-selling book covering energy and energy policy. As many of you know, due to the foundational role that fossil fuels play in our modern economy, we at Financial Sense NewsHour have long expressed quite a bit of skepticism on the ability to implement a rapid energy transition. This was something that Peter Zeihan also mentioned in our interview with him earlier this week, and today we'll dive into this topic into much greater depth with Alex Epstein. Again, we consider this a must-read book and hope you enjoy this fascinating and decidedly non-politically correct conversation that made it to one of our favorites for the year.
FS Insider, a premium edition of the Financial Sense NewsHour. Today's host is Financial Sense Wealth Management President Jim Poplava.
Well, we've been hearing a lot about this transition to a green economy. Will it work, and is wind and solar capable of replacing a system that runs about 80% on fossil fuels? Joining me on the program today is Alex Epstein. He's an energy expert and founder of the Center for Industrial Progress, which offers a positive pro-human alternative to the green movement. His New York Times best-selling book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, has been widely praised, and he received the Most Original Thinker Award of 2014 from the McLaughlin Group. His new book is called Fossil Future, Why Global Human Flourishing Requires More Oil, Coal, and Natural Gas, Not Less. Alex, before we begin, I wonder if you would just share with our audience a little bit about your background. What got you into looking into energy? I mean, were you a geologist? What was your background and what brought you here?
No, definitely was not a geologist. I mean, I grew up in a very conventional background educationally in terms of the views that I was exposed to. So I grew up in a place called Chevy Chase, Maryland, which is a liberal suburb in the Washington, D.C. area. I mean, I was fortunate to go to sort of elite schools, particularly focused on math and science. And in college, I went to Duke, but I was only exposed to anti-fossil fuel views. And I had a technical education, but my main love was actually philosophy. And that's what I decided to focus on and to become what I call a practical philosopher. And to make a long story short, what philosophy helped me with is it enabled me to realize that the way we are thinking about energy in general and fossil fuels in particular is very illogical. And I don't just mean that people who are uneducated are illogical. I think particularly people who are very educated are illogical. And in Fossil Future, I go into this and I show that what you know, our designated experts, the people we're trusting to help us think through this and to give us expert knowledge, they're obviously committing a very basic error, which is that they are ignoring the benefits of something and just focusing on the side effects. So you would never do this with a prescription drug. You never say, hey, I'm just going to look at the side effects. I'm not going to look at the benefits, because you could deprive yourself of a life-saving benefit. And yet with fossil fuels, notice how rarely we talk about the benefits and how often we talk about the negative side effects. And I argue that the benefits are huge. You indicated, I mean, 80% of the world's energy is fossil fuels, but really in a sense, 100% is, because every other form of energy depends massively on things that only fossil fuels can do, particularly things that only oil can do right now. And so that suggests, if you understand energy at all, that fossil fuels are amazingly beneficial. And yet we talk about rapidly eliminating them without any focus on the benefits and just focusing on the negative side effects. And that's just as if you evaluated the polio vaccine by just focusing on the negative side effects and not the benefits, you'd make a terrible decision.
I want to talk about, in your first book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, which has been vindicated. I wonder if you might talk about the three things. For example, fossil fuels are still the dominant source of energy, and the world has become a better place to live, especially for the poorest people, giving them low-cost, reliable energy. If we can cover that briefly before we move forward.
Well, you mentioned this idea of this green energy transition. And that was something, when Moral Case came out in 2014, that was a prevalent idea. It's become even more prevalent. But back in 2014, people were saying solar and wind are cheap fuels. They're going to rapidly replace them. et cetera, et cetera. And one of the arguments I made is that's not going to happen. And one is because when you're thinking about replacing fossil fuels, you need to recognize the world needs far more energy. So you're not just replacing the same portion of the same pie. You need to replace fossil fuels are 80%+ of a growing pie. And so the idea that you would really even make a dent in it, let alone rapidly start to replace it, was implausible for that reason, if you realize growing need, growing demand. But then also, if you look at what fossil fuels do and how they do it, solar and wind are just not competitive with much of what they do. I mean, solar and wind, first of all, they just provide electricity, which right now is 1/5 of the world's energy. And what I observed in 2014 and what's still true today is they are fundamentally dependent on fossil fuels. There's no grid in the world that just uses solar and wind and then batteries to back them up or long distance transmission lines to interconnect them. They really depend on reliable, controllable sources of electricity, namely natural gas, coal, and nuclear, and also hydro. But you know, above all, natural gas, because natural gas is the most flexible thing that accommodates the rapid ups and downs of wind and solar. And so if you just recognize these are not self-sufficient forms of energy, they're very dependent. And then they're just providing electricity, which is just one form of energy. It's different from, say, very concentrated liquid fuel for transportation. Electricity is often not the best way to generate high amounts of heat for industry. So if you just realize, hey, this is not very good, it's not self-sufficient at providing 1/5 of the world's energy, which is electricity, then you think, you would never think, oh, we're going to rapidly replace fossil fuels with solar and wind. And then if you look at the other alternatives, there are various reasons why they're not going to rapidly replace fossil fuels either.
Now, in your book, you talk about this goal that they have of getting us to net zero policy would be almost the equivalent of mass murder. Explain that.
I think it would be mass murder. And this is considered an offensive view, but it's actually net zero should be what is offensive, because all I'm pointing out is its consequences. If you just look at the basic facts of reality, I mentioned 80% of the world's energy is from fossil fuels. There's no near-term replacement. The world needs far more energy. So we have 3 billion people, for example, using less electricity than a typical American refrigerator. And then on top of that, energy is not some minor convenience. It's what I call an essential of human flourishing. The more energy we can use, the more we can use machines to go from a deficient and dangerous world to an abundant and safe world. It makes us incredibly productive. Without machines, we can't be productive. We'll always be poor and endangered. So you have something that's essential to human life that we need far more of, and fossil fuels are uniquely good at providing. And then you're saying by the year 2050, we're essentially going to get rid of this life-saving thing. I mean, what could, just take agriculture. I mean, we're already having agricultural problems because of rising natural gas prices, which are due to artificial shortages. But we're saying, hey, let's basically get rid of natural gas or most natural gas in the next 27 or so years. I mean, this is just, there's no way to kill more people more efficiently than making energy inaccessible. Because if we don't have energy, then all the machines that sustain us don't work. And we have a population of 8 billion people on a planet that cannot support it. The planet cannot support 8 billion people without machines. It can barely support 500 million people without machines. And it did so when it did at a very poor standard of living. So if you realize fossil fuels powering all the life-sustaining machines that allow 8 billion people to live, then you do see, yeah, net zero is mass murder.
I want to talk about something. When you hear these things about solar and wind, why do the environmentalists always exclude nuclear energy or hydroelectric energy, even though nuclear and hydro are the world's two largest sources of non-carbon energy? I don't understand their thinking behind that.
Well, it doesn't make sense if you think of it as the green movement really loves energy and they just hate CO2 emissions, which is how they try to position themselves, because they say we're for green energy or clean energy. They don't say we're against energy and CO2 emissions are just opposing those, or one really, that's a really efficient way of opposing energy because you're covering 80% of the world's energy. I think that is in fact what's going on with the leadership. And that's vindicated by what you pointed out. They have huge hostility toward hydro, which is quote unquote renewable, if that means anything. It doesn't mean anything because no process, if you look at all the elements, is quote renewable. But if you just take, hey, it's involving these natural forces, well, Hydro involves natural forces, and yet it gets excluded from definitions of renewable and certainly from definitions of green. And nuclear certainly gets excluded from definitions of green, even though it's the most impressive non-fossil fuel form of energy. I think what's going on, and what I elaborate on in chapter 3 of Fossil Futures, if you look at what the opposition has in common, it's always saying impact is bad. So nuclear is bad because it creates this new form of waste, even though we're very good at dealing with this waste and it's not killing people. Otherwise, we would see all these deaths due to waste. Or you hear hydro, it's impeding free-flowing rivers. They'll talk about that. And so notice they're more concerned about not impacting rivers than they are about improving human life with low carbon energy. And then with fossil fuels, it's of course CO2, but you notice there's no concern with the benefits that are lost due to lack of fossil fuels. And also even with CO2, there's no precision at all about how significant the negatives are. And there's a total ignoring of any positives of CO2. CO2 is a warming gas. Most of the world is too cold for people. Many more people die of cold than of heat. And then CO2 is also a fertilizing gas that's made the earth far greener. So what you see is there's this constant thread of opposing human impact being the highest goal and not really caring about human life. And what this points to me is the real goal animating this movement is what I call eliminating human impact on nature, not advancing human flourishing. I think for the leadership, they're more clearly anti-human. They view humans as this like devil species that they want to get rid of, or they want to be in charge of getting rid of a lot of them, at least. But more conventionally, I think people have been in various ways deluded into thinking in an anti-human way. So I think people who are kind of pro-human at core, they think of this issue in a way that's anti-human, in that notice the culture cares far more about a change in the habitat of polar bears than it does about 3 billion people using almost no electricity. And so I think we've been taught to think of this in an anti-human way. And this is from somebody who's, polar bear is my favorite animal, but the fact that we're obsessed with them having to move from one piece of ice to another, and that's what makes us cry, but we don't care about 3 billion people with virtually no electricity. We've definitely been taught to think about this in an anti-human way.
Yeah, you talk about the cost effectiveness of energy. It has four elements. It's affordable, it's reliable, it's versatile, and four, its scalability. And that's what you can do with fossil fuels that is not as easy to do with just wind and solar.
Yeah, I mean, none of those are really done with wind and solar. Sometimes what they'll say is, I'm laughing because it's not funny because it's such a distortion, but it's funny because it's so insane. They'll say solar and wind are now cheaper than fossil fuels. The only problem is reliability. We just need to make them reliable. But unreliable energy is not a very valuable thing. And sometimes it can be a problem. So it's just like, hey, we've solved the problem. You have a new, let's say, a rental car place. And they say, hey, we have cheaper cars and they work a third of the time. So we've solved the problem of cheapness, but they work a third of the time and you don't know when they're going to work. That hasn't solved any problem of cheapness. That's not the same product. You know, technically, we can call this the energy fungibility fallacy, if you want to get technical. They're treating something that's unreliable as the equivalent of what's reliable. And in particular, in electricity, this makes no sense, because the whole thing with electricity is you need to very precisely match supply to demand. That's what the modern grid does. And it's very problematic to have something, an uncontrollable supply that is always either too much or too little, and often drastically so, particularly in the case of too little. So they're not actually cheaper if you look at the full cost of delivering reliable electricity, which is what we want. And then, of course, they're not reliable. And then versatile, they're only providing electricity, and they're not even really providing that. And then scalability, well, you can't scale it because it's just totally dependent. Insofar as you do try to scale it, you often create a lot of problems. So solar and wind, it's more interesting with, say, hydro, because hydro, you can create, say, low-cost, reliable electricity, but it only applies to electricity and it's limited by the right topography, you know, to have the right rivers and build dams and that kind of thing. And then nuclear, I think, is the most promising, because we know from history, it can be low cost. It's certainly reliable. It can be scaled. There's nothing about the material that's in short supply, but it's not yet versatile as fossil fuels. Like, it's not powering airplanes, and it's mostly just providing electricity. But we know from experience, it can power aircraft carriers and icebreakers and these huge mobile machines. And so there's a lot of reason to be enthusiastic about nuclear mobility. And then, of course, submarines as well, our Navy is nuclear Navy. And then also there's the potential, I think they could generate electricity cheaply enough at some point if they were really liberated, that then you could synthesize fuels using them, whether that's hydrogen or something else. But you would need super, super cheap, reliable electricity to do that.
I want to talk about China, because China is excluded from a lot of the things in terms of the Paris Peace Accords. And you talk about in your book, China's energy production is 85% fossil fuels. They're basically eating our lunch, not in using solar and wind, but using fossil fuels, including electricity that is 64% coal to produce energy. I mean, it's considered the manufacturing center of the world, and it runs on fossil fuels.
One statistic about China that I find particularly striking and alarming is that their industrial electricity use is 5 times ours. So think about this, 5 times more industrial electricity use, because that's what's really related to your productivity, specifically your manufacturing, right? So yeah, of course, as consumers, we use a lot more, way more per capita than China because we're wealthy. But if you look at what's actually producing physical goods, they're doing way more of that. And our industrial electricity has generally been flat. Insofar as going up, it's okay, it's data centers, but where are those things being, you know, the components of those being made? Mostly not here. So it really, really points to two things. I think one is just we have very bad industrial policy that's really driven by this green movement that says impact is bad and we shouldn't impact anything. And insofar as you have that, you're not going to be building a lot of factories. It's going to be too expensive to develop the world because anti-impact means anti-development. But then also we have all these this opposition of fossil fuels, whereas China's focused on what's the most cost-effective thing. That's why they're using so much coal and why they're committing to building more new coal than the total amount of coal we use right now. So, and there's this huge evasion by our leaders who are pretending, oh, China's this green revolution. Really what they're doing is they're using coal and other fossil fuels to produce unreliable solar and wind that then is making our electricity less reliable and more expensive.
I want to move forward and talk about the doomsday alarmist, because when you hear the Greens talk about this, I can remember, I think it was 2003, Al Gore gave us 10 years for the planet to survive. You've seen members of Congress saying we got 10 more years to live. Everything is always a doomsday scenario. Unless we adopt all these policies now, we're going to die.
I think it's an astute observation. If you go back in history, you can see this kind of claim being made and coming false in a very striking way. I talk about this a lot in chapter 2 of Fossil Future. I call it's called catastrophizing side effects. And one thing I observe is that there's this history of taking different aspects of fossil fuel use. So for example, taking its effect on climate, and there was catastrophic global cooling, then catastrophic global warming. But in both cases, we're actually safer than ever from climate. So there hasn't been a catastrophe in either direction. And in fact, the energy we get from fossil fuels has made us far, far safer from climate. And whatever effects there have been on climate, they haven't been nearly as significant, even climate-wise, as the benefits we get. And then there was this idea that, oh, the pollution is going to overwhelm us. And no, wait a second. We've actually reduced our pollution a lot thanks to technology and more economic ways of pollution control. And then also we've used energy from fossil fuels to clean up nature, things like more available clean water. That's an achievement of machines powered by fossil fuels. And then you look at, oh, we're going to run out of resources, including fossil fuels. And actually, no, we have more resource than ever because human ingenuity keeps discovering new ways to find and develop fossil fuels. And then also the more energy we have, the more we can make use of all the other raw materials on the planet and make them cheaply enough to actually be resources instead of just useless stuff in the ground. So what you find is, I call it being 180 degrees wrong, the doomsayers, or as I call them, the catastrophists. They're not just wrong that there's not a catastrophe. They're the opposite of right. It's 180 degrees wrong because life actually gets better. So they keep predicting the world will get worse when it gets better. And one reason I think for this is what I call in chapter 3, the delicate nurturer assumption, which is the idea that nature exists in a delicate nurturing balance that human beings and our impact ruin. We ruin that delicate balance. And that's a dogma. That doesn't make any sense. It's not a scientific view, but unfortunately many, many scientists have it. So their fear is always around, hey, the next human impact is going to disrupt the delicate balance, versus I view nature as wild potential. So it's It has the potential to be really good, but on its own, it's dynamic. It's deficient, deficient, doesn't have enough resources for us. It's dangerous and we need to impact a lot. So it creates a lot of, they create a lot of fear of impact. And I think we should fundamentally be afraid of not impacting the earth. Because if we don't impact the earth, it's not a good place to live for anyone and certainly not 8 billion people.
I want to talk about something that people rarely hear about. I mean, if you take the modern world that we live in, it was made possible by machines, and machines run on fossil fuels. But if you think, Alex, of the world we live in, all the electrical devices that we have to charge at night, our laptops, our iPads, our watches, our phones, then you add EVs to that, and now there's another mandate or possible mandate coming from the administration. They're going to get rid of gas stovetops. I mean, just think what that's going to do to the restaurant industry, what it's going to do to the way we cook. But as we use more devices that require electricity and charging, we're destabilizing the grid with wind and solar that's unreliable. I mean, my own state of California last year, during the summer heat wave, the governor asked us not to charge our EVs from 3 to 8 o'clock at night. You've seen places in Texas and elsewhere where the system has gone down because it's unreliable.
Yeah, I live in California as well, and it's really an embarrassment to be driving on the highway and to be seeing these signs that say very prominently, I don't know what the, you know, sometimes it's 5 to 9, they probably have other times, but it's saying, like, don't use electricity. And it's during a heat wave, right? So it's don't use your air conditioner, don't charge your EV. And one of these announcements came 5 days after Newsom said, hey, we're getting rid of internal combustion vehicles by 2035. And there's all this fanfare. And then it's a few days later, 5 days later, it says, no, don't charge your EVs. And we have 3% EVs. So what we have is we have this incredible movement, incredibly terrible movement, I should say, where you've got this combination of destroying the supply of reliable electricity and then increasing demand for reliable electricity. And the reduction of the supply is very, very striking, and it's not being talked about. If people go to the website energytalkingpoints.com, I have a lot of information there. Just search electricity and you'll see an article called Electricity Emergency at energytalkingpoints.com. And you'll see we are headed toward losing 1/5 of our reliable power plants in the next 7 years. Like, this is where we're heading right now. And we already have huge reliability problems. We're now afraid of the summer and the winter. So it's mostly targeting coal. So it's just, we just villainized coal. Yet coal is keeping us alive right now. Like, if we didn't have these coal plants, it'd be an absolute constant. We'd have a third world grid. And that's what, unfortunately, this administration is obsessed with above all, is just shutting down coal plants and pretending that unreliable solar and wind are going to replace them. And then it's you're destroying your reliable electricity, and then you are increasing demand for reliable electricity. And then you can see that a lot of the people in power, they like the idea of what they'll call, like, curtailment, or they have different weird names for things, demand management, they'll sometimes call it. But that basically means we can cut off your electricity. So you had some customers last year in Colorado who had signed up for some green thing, and they found, oh wait, we can't air condition below 90 degrees. Or in Spain, they had commercial buildings cannot air condition below 81 degrees. And then you're seeing in different places in Germany, you know, you need to take cold showers. So there's this desire to centralize everything, make us dependent, and then cut off the supply of reliable electricity, increase demand, and massively increase government control. And it's controlled by people, I would argue, who do not really care about energy. So they're more than happy at the core to deprive us of energy, because ultimately they think we're using too much energy. And they also think there are too many of us and we're having too many kids. And so this is the last thing you want, is anti-energy, anti-human people controlling one centralized grid. And that's what we have. And it's heading in a really bad direction. We really need to wake up.
I find it ironic sometimes there. I think it was Earth Summit that was held in Europe, I think, a couple of years ago. And everybody there, they came in their mega yachts, and there were more private jets that came to this Earth Summit, whatever it was. So these are the leading green people. These are sort of the elites. And yet the way they live and the way they consume and use energy is different for what they want for you and I.
There's a lot of interesting aspects of this. I think the core aspect is they actually have a case for being green, in that what their core argument, and it's an evil argument, but it's an argument, is we are reducing more CO2 emissions by meeting here and by passing policies that restrict fossil fuels than we're using with the jet. So you, John Kerry, I think, infamously said something like, I need to do this. And what he means is, in order to stop other people from using fossil fuels as quickly as possible, I need to use a lot of fossil fuels. That's their argument. And that's a true argument, but it's terrible because what they're really saying is, to do important things, I need fossil fuels. But then their important thing is to stop other people from living their lives using fossil fuels, which I think people living their lives is a much more important thing than people going to these destructive conferences. So in a sense, they're not hypocrites. But then also, I think what you get is, why do you have these private jets and yachts and stuff? And I think a lot of the people who are motivated to be, quote, leaders here are very status driven. And so that's part of it, is they gravitate toward, hey, let's go to a luxury resort and let's fly in the most convenient way and the most kind of conspicuous way. It's, I think, part of understanding the green movement is understanding that it's become this status movement. And so people who want status are now saying, I want to be green, and they don't really care about the details of it. It's more like they just want the trappings of it. So first it was, you just buy a Prius and then you buy a Tesla. Does it really make any sense that you're going to, on a grid that's fossil fueled, you're going to buy a second or third car and pay Elon Musk to make, and you think that's really going to stop CO2? It doesn't make any sense, but it shows, oh, it's a status thing. It's also, it has a religious quality. So there's a lot of ritual to it. It's the opposite of a scientific movement. And it's a really, really dangerous movement. And so I'm glad these people are being called out. But I do think the number one thing they need to be called out is, they're trying to restrict fossil fuel use, which is essential for 8 billion people to live. That's the main thing, not that they are, in a certain sense, hypocrites.
So when you take a look at this and the things that you write about in your book, and we're seeing it backfire, whether you saw it in Texas, whether you saw it in California during the summer, but they kind of doubled down on this. But how do you get this information out? Because the mainstream media doesn't cover it, like they're rioting in Paris right now over high food costs, high energy costs. That's not covered in the media. And then, you know, you take your kids, they go to school, this is what they're taught. So you've got people like Greta Thunberg, who thinks that, you know, she doesn't want to have kids because they'll die. And, you know, you had Germany, the Chancellor of Germany, getting her permission to restart their nuclear plants. I mean, I've never seen anything this crazy.
I mean, the use of these, like, quote unquote, innocent children, I think has a very sordid history with anti-freedom and anti-reason movements, I think, because part of it is they just think, oh, our view is obvious. And so we really just need a child to wake us up, versus, no, your view is not obvious. The reason we're not executing your view to the degree you want is because it would kill a lot of people. So people are not following these policies you're advocating out of self-preservation. But by putting up somebody like Greta, the idea is, oh, the scientists have spoken, it's obvious. Even this little girl knows, and let's just listen to her. And she's really mad, and she should be mad at us, versus she shouldn't be mad. She should be glad that we have a fossil fueled world where she has more opportunity than anyone in history, and where her kids are likely to have that if we don't adopt the policies that she wants. So the rise of somebody like Greta shows you that there's a lot of infrastructure that is eager to push the anti-fossil fuel view and to push the catastrophist view. But we do live in a world where it's much easier now for any individual to get a lot of attention than it was before, because we now have social media, which has many challenges to it. But at the core, what it allows you to do is access a very, very broad audience if you can create things that are appealing in different ways. So let's say, I don't know how many followers I have on Twitter, but I think it's something like 155,000. No, that's quite a decent audience. And then sometimes I'll write something and it's seen by millions of people. And then, you know, also there, of course, there are more inclined networks and stuff like that. I mean, as you might imagine, Fox is more sympathetic to my views than say MSNBC. But even some CNBC stuff you'll see before this. So I feel like if you can explain ideas clearly and compellingly to people, you can reach bigger and bigger audiences. And so, of course, I want to reach bigger audiences. Also, I have two books on this that have both sold very well. So I think if people are want to have an impact, I'd say just take advantage of social media and share really, really effective things. And I would highly recommend, of course, they can check out the book Fossil Future. If you're a student, by the way, or if you know a student, if they go to fossilfuture.com, they can actually get the book for free, which is pretty cool. And then the website I mentioned, energytalkingpoints.com, that's all totally free and has really effective arguments on everything you can imagine. So I think if you use really good resources and you take advantage of the social sharing we have, you can have a really big impact.
You know, Alex, are you hopeful with this? Because what I've, like this week, they're coming out and they want to get rid of natural gas stovetops for all of us. And it seems like the more you see this backfiring, not working, whether it was California last summer, whether it was Texas during the winter, but they seem to be doubling down. And it's almost like, we got to get this done. We got to get this done, or, you know, we're not going to be here. So are you hopeful that you're starting to see maybe people wake up and say, wait a minute, this doesn't seem to make sense?
I am, for two core reasons. One, I think, is that there are better arguments on my side of things that are getting a lot of traction. So, you know, people who are thinking about this issue in a similar way to me, in terms of thinking about it in a pro-human way, in terms of actually thinking about the benefits of fossil fuels, not just any negatives. You know, there's me, there's Michael Schellenberger, who's become quite prominent. There's Bjorn Lomborg, there's Steve Koonin. I'd say we're you know, among the top four. There's a new, really interesting Substack called Doomberg that's become quite well known and influential. And what you're seeing, and I'm seeing more and more people pop up and start to rise to prominence who are thinking about energy in this humanistic, rational way. So that's one thing. And then and you're seeing it get picked up. So for example, I was on Jordan Peterson's show recently. He's been really picking up on these arguments. A couple of people I mentioned have been on Joe Rogan's show making these arguments, Lex Friedman's show making these arguments. So you're seeing these arguments spread in different kinds of ways. And then at the same time, as you've indicated, we have reality rearing its head. And what's happened is we've had these policies that say, hey, don't worry about restricting fossil fuels because unreliable solar and wind can easily replace them. And that's coming false. And it has a lot of really adverse consequences and people are really mad about it. And so the green movement's response is to deny all responsibility and just to say, no, it's not us. It's just all Russia and everything will be great once, you know, Putin's invasion stops. I mean, which definitely should stop. And I definitely support Ukraine against Russia. But they're denying the fact that their policies are the core thing that have made energy prices rise in general and reliability decline, and that made us so vulnerable to Putin. Because if we had had better energy policies, it would have been much easier for the U.S. and others to scale up production instead of, you know, begging to Saudi Arabia, begging to Venezuela, even and depending on Russia. So I think the combination of better arguments being available and an energy crisis that indicates to people there's something wrong, I think that's a really powerful combination. I do really advocate people getting resources and sharing them and make sure that the right people are held accountable for the energy crisis. Because those people are dead. I have not seen one of them apologize, the anti-fossil fuel people. I've not seen one public apology. So that said, you need to, if somebody's not going to apologize, you need to make clear that they should apologize. They're not going to do it on their own, we've seen so far.
Well, Alex, as we close, tell people how they can follow you, your website, and how they can get this information.
Yes, the two resources I just point to people to are energytalkingpoints.com, because that's a website you can just search for any issue, and it has really concise, powerful, well-referenced points, and they're all free and easy to share. So, and there's a newsletter you can sign up for there, so energytalkingpoints.com. Then fossilfuture.com. So that just has every way to get my book, Fossil Future, and anything associated with it. If people want to, you know, inquire about me as a speaker, you can learn about it there. If you're a student who wants a free copy of the book or an educator wants a free copy of the book, just go to fossilfuture.com. That has all the links. And then, of course, I am on all forms of social media. So if you like social media, I share a lot of valuable content.
Yeah, so the name of the book is called Fossil Future, Why Global Human Flourishing Requires More Oil, Coal, and Natural Gas, Not Less, by Alex Epstein, who's been my guest. Alex, thank you for doing and putting out the great work, because I think we're seeing more and more evidence of the realities of what's happening, whether you can't charge your EV, you can't get heating, you can't get cooling, more and more of that. And you know, the thing that really hit me when I read your book, the one big thing that hit me, is machines. The world that we live in today, you take a modern factory, even a Tesla factory, look at those robots and the machines. Our life today was made possible by machines which require fossil fuels. Great, great book. So thanks so much for being on the program, and all the best, and keep up the great work.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.